I would like to introduce to Peter Womack from University of East Anglia, who's going to speak about Spanish tragedy.
Thank you very much, Maurice. I should probably start with two apologies. The first one is that I'm not exactly sure in preparing this lecture who I'm talking to, and now that I'm in the room, I know for a fact that the audience includes the foremost expert on Elizabethan and Jacobean theatre in England at the moment, and also one or two people who know nothing about it whatever. I know that because they're my relatives. So I will probably be giving far too much elementary explanation for some of you and not nearly enough for others. And I will try and pick my way between this Scylla and Charybdis. The other apology is that most of what you're going to see on the screen by way of helping you to follow the argument will be words. And I'm deeply embarrassed to be in one of the most spectacular collections of visual material in London and presenting you with such a kind of visually anorexic display on the screen. But, you know, I'm a words person, I'm not a visuals person, and that's what you've got. So that's the end of the apologies, and now on with the question that led me to want to talk about the Spanish tragedy, which is very simply, crassly even, what did Shakespeare's audiences like? What did they come to see? Sometimes when we talk about the appeal of one play or the power of another play, we talk as if their enjoyments were much the same as our own. After all, we know, we've got documentary evidence that early 17th century spectators wept for Desdemona, that they laughed at Falstaff, that they thought Hamlet was a great play. In all these ways, they're just like us. But somehow this common ground doesn't bring us closer to them. It's an experience that doesn't have enough otherness in it to suggest the rhythm and feel of a historically distinctive theatre. So a special value, it seems to me, attaches to a play that exemplifies early modern theatrical pleasure as opposed to ours. And it's in that spirit that I want to talk about the Spanish tragedy. Not that I want to persuade you that it's a particularly exciting or wonderful play. I don't think it is. And anyway, that isn't the question that concerns us. Rather, what's interesting about it is that as far as we can tell, this was one of the plays that audiences and readers in early modern London loved. It was first performed in the mid to late 1580s and was a familiar subject of allusions and jokes right through to 1642. That is, for practically the whole time that Shakespearean theatre existed at all, the Spanish tragedy was part of it, while other cleverer plays came and went. So what is this play like? Well, it's a revenge tragedy. Arguably, it's the first English revenge tragedy, and its hero is a Spanish court official named Hieronymo. Hieronymo's son, Horatio, I'm not going to do the plot at great length. Hieronymo's son, Horatio, falls in love with the King of Spain's niece, who's magnificently called Belimperia, but she is destined for a diplomatic marriage to a Portuguese prince, so her brother, Lorenzo, has Horatio murdered. The rest of the play shows Hieronymo mourning his son, discovering who killed him, and eventually devising a spectacular revenge upon them before dying by his own hand. Now, the currency of this play is attested by dozens of allusions in tracts, pamphlets, anecdotes, and above all, in other plays. Here's a random example. The first scene of a 1609 comedy called The Woman is a Weathercock. And this is the very opening of the play, and a gentleman named Neville is calling on his friend. "What? Up already, Scudmore? Ne'er a wench with thee? Good morrow, my dear Neville. What's this? A letter? Sure it is not so, a letter written to Hieronymo. "By heavens, you must excuse me. Come, I know you will not wrong my friendship and your manners to tempt me so." Now, if you know any Restoration comedies, you'll feel at home here. This is two young men on familiar terms, one teasing, the other more reserved, and a slight mystery around what's in the letter to set the plot going. It's a confident, easy opening. We know where we are with this. But then what's striking about it is the quotation. In the Spanish tragedy, after Horatio has been murdered, Belimperia, the heroine, is imprisoned, but she contrives to write a letter in her own blood and drop it where Hieronymo finds it. Hieronymo picks it up, this is in the Spanish tragedy, and exclaims, "What's here? A letter? Tush, it is not so. A letter written to Hieronymo." Now, this is hardly a deathless couplet on anybody's terms, but it is evidently so famous that merely seeing a letter puts it into Neville's mind, and the playwright is sure that the audience will recognize the quotation. What he's saying is kind of incomprehensible if they don't. And it's also telling, I think, that Scudamore, the other character, doesn't comment on Neville's allusion to the play. It's too ordinary to be noticed. The line has quite literally passed into the language. The same is true, incidentally, of the phrase "go by." To go by means to avoid something, to leave it on one side, and Hieronymo says it to himself at one point in the plot when he's in danger of walking into a trap. He susses the trap and says to himself, "Hieronymo, beware, go by, go by." And this unremarkable utterance is quoted endlessly. If anyone's read much around in this period, it sometimes seems maddeningly that if an early 17th century Englishman said, "go by," he actually had to go on and add "Hieronymo." He couldn't help himself. Now, these indications are quite trivial in themselves, but what they indicate, it seems to me, is an extraordinary celebrity. Hieronymo was not an independently famous figure like Julius Caesar or Robin Hood. He was a purely fictional character with no presence outside the play. And yet, it's hardly an exaggeration to say that within a decade or two of his first being invented, his name was on everybody's lips. So, what are the elements of this fame? What is it about this not very great play that took possession of people's imaginations and memories? Looking at the allusions together with the script of the play itself, I can see three possible answers to that question. Three arguments which flow into one another, but which I shall try to keep separate for the sake of clarity. There is an argument about emotion, about the power of the play to generate strong feeling. There is an argument about theatricality, about the pleasure not simply of this play or that play, but of theatre as such. And there is an argument about social class. So that's what you're in for. That's the three bits of this talk. First of all, the emotions. Sometime in the early 17th century, there was a young gentlewoman who loved going to plays, and then one day she fell fatally ill, during which time of her sickness, being exhorted by such divines as were there present to call upon God, that he would in mercy look upon her, as one deaf to their exhortation, she continued ever crying, "O Hieronymo, Hieronymo, methinks I see thee, brave Hieronymo." Neither could she be drawn from this with all their persuasions, but fixing her eyes intentively, as if she had seen Hieronymo acted, sending out a deep sigh, she suddenly died. In another account of this incident, which I haven't put up, The unfortunate lady doesn't actually hallucinate, but she expresses her longing to be in the playhouse once more. This is the other version. A minister advising her to repent and call upon God for mercy, she made him no reply at all, but cried out, "Hieronymo, Hieronymo, oh, let me see Hieronymo acted," calling out for a play, the narrator comments, instead of crying unto God for mercy, and so closed her dying eyes. Oh, tragical, oh, fearful death. However this story is told, its point is that the play has communicated an emotion so imperious that it overrides the exhortations of the clergyman and the fear of death and of damnation. The lady devotes her last breath to her passion for Hieronymo. Of course, this is a story. It does not give us a direct report on the feelings of actual audiences. What it does give us is an image of theatrical communication in a way that strikes the devout narrators as a kind of unholy possession. The spectator is agitated by the influences she has absorbed from the stage. Another fictitious witness in a play of 1620 recalls seeing a player personate Hieronymo and paint grief in such a lively colour that for false and acted passion he has drawn true tears from the spectators. Ladies in the boxes kept time with sighs and tears to his sad accents. Now, the tone here is obviously much more decorous and complimentary than it is in the stories about the misguided gentlewoman. But the musical metaphor suggests the same mysterious connection between the male actor and the female spectators, almost a physiological link between them. Hieronymo, then, is the name, among other things, for a kind of emotion, contagious, excessive, implicitly erotic. In all this, by the way, you can see how much it's the celebrity of a role that's in question. No one refers to the play as the Spanish tragedy. Everybody calls it Hieronymo. And you see, I've followed their example in this lecture. The show, in other words, is a star vehicle. It seems likely that it was played at different times by both the leading tragedians of the age, Alain and Burbage, which was an unusual thing to happen. And many of the references to the role suggests that it was popularly remembered as a series of high points. One high point we've already seen, it's the bit when he says, "Go by." Another one, arguably an even higher high point, is the moment when Hieronymo discovers the body of his murdered son. Horatio is stabbed and then hanged in an arbor. The sounds of the struggle rouse Hieronymo from his bed, and he has an action-packed soliloquy of about 30 lines in which he seeks out the source of the noise, finds the suspended corpse, cuts it down, recognizes his son, and breaks out in protest and lamentation. And this is the speech which is pictured on the title page of the 1615 and subsequent editions of the play. This is a rather famous document in Elizabethan theatre history because we have very few graphic images of what appears to be part of the performance of a play. I haven't done very well with that one, but if you look carefully, you can see from left to right, there is the unfortunate Horatio hanging in the arbor. Then, moving to the right, there's Hieronymo, who is uttering the discovery line, "Alas, it is my son Horatio." And then to the right of him, there's Belimperia, and at the far right, there is one of the murderers. This scene, then, not so much the scene in which Horatio is hanged as the scene in which Hieronymo discovers him, is the object of several parodies, some of which are so detailed that they suggest that audiences could almost be expected to know this scene off by heart. One suggestive example of this is in a tragedy called The Rebellion, first performed in 1638. So just note how late that is. That's a generation after the 1615 edition and a lifetime after the play was first performed. In The Rebellion, there's a group of tailors in the comic subplot who are discussing putting on a play, and as in A Midsummer Night's Dream, which the writer is clearly heavily drawing on, the noisiest and most clownish of the tailors wants to play all the parts. So when the question comes up, who shall act Geronimo, he says, "That will I. Mark, if I do not gape wider than the widest mouth fowler of them all, hang me. Who calls Geronimo from his naked bed? Now, for the passionate part. Alas, it is my son Horatio." Now, for this amateur actor, Geronimo is all about vocal violence. Is presumably the kind of inarticulate cry which he thinks that the performance calls for. And he claims to eclipse rival interpreters of the part by opening his mouth wider than they can. You see what I mean? It's all about vocal extremes. It's all about being very loud, very vehement, very forceful. And you see, he's impatient to get to the passionate part. Alas, it is my son Horatio. That's the moment when you really throw yourself into it. Non-actors, this play is implying, act along with that bit. It's like playing air guitar. And as with guitars, part of the fantasy is that while you play, the ladies keep time with sighs and tears. The attraction is what you're doing to the audience. When we look at the script, it seems to me that the popular audience is not wrong to identify the passionate part as the point of the show. Hieronymus' passion is a primary effect of the dramatic structure. I think we can go back to the picture because it'll help this bit. When I say that it's an effect of structure, what I mean is this. Revenge tragedy is almost bound to have an underlying binary rhythm as a show. There's an originating crime which sets the narrative in motion, and eventually there is a second matching action, the revenge, which completes the narrative and brings it to an end. These two events are objective, symmetrical, and all-determining. Between them, they dictate the architecture of the play. But in order to work like that, they must have a space between them. They must have a pause, a waiting for completion. Revenge tragedy, in short, is a form that needs an empty bit in the middle. Empty in the sense that it isn't plot, it isn't decisive action, it isn't positive dramatic content, because if it were any of those things, it wouldn't constitute space in the middle, which is what's needed. We're very familiar with this argument because it affects us every time we approach Hamlet. In the Spanish tragedy, this space is very clearly demarcated. The play has four acts, and the discovery of the body more or less concludes Act Two, and the revenge gets going in Act Four. So Act Three, which is a long act with lots of scenes in it, is the bit in the middle. And what is poured into this bit in the middle, this pause, is emotion. "Where shall I run to breathe abroad my woes?" Hieronimo asks at the beginning of one scene. And the question sums up his attitude for the act as a whole. Denied practical expression by this pause in the plot, Hieronimo's grief and rage erupt in furious movement. He runs manically about the stage, and in the noisy rhetoric in which he breathes abroad his woes, with seven or eight big set-piece speeches in the course of the act. The whole sequence, in other words, is essentially a framework for Hieronimo's solo outbursts. Action is suspended in order to create space for passion. I imagine it in a way as analogous in some ways to popular opera, that people went to hear these big numbers that the star actor in Hieronymo performed, and they must have been like arias. This space, interestingly, actually got bigger as time went by. Editions after 1602, including the 1615 one with the picture, advertise new enlargements and additions. I don't know if you can see that, but it says newly corrected, amended, and enlarged with new additions as it hath of late been divers time acted. And these supplementary passages turn out to be extra opportunities on top of the many afforded by the original script for Hieronymo to perform his passions. For example, there's a thing which is called the painter's part. This is a scene where Hieronymo meets a painter and tells him how to depict the night when he discovered Horatio's body. So this new scene adds nothing to the story. What it does is to revisit an episode which was already famous and enact the anguish of that night all over again. So the fact that the script was amended in that direction gives us a very clear indication of what the audience were coming to see. When they came to see the amended Hieronymo, they didn't want new stuff. What they wanted was more outbursts of feeling about the same stuff. And a further code we can add for Hieronymo's breathing abroad his woes is madness. He digs in the ground with his dagger to try and reach his son in the underworld. He addresses an old man as Horatio and exclaims that death has aged him. And other characters deal with the violence of Hieronymo's behavior by saying that he's lunatic. So this madness also became famous. Several casual allusions speak of mad Hieronymo, and you see that our title page has supplied a subtitle for the play, Hieronymo is Mad Again. This phrase is not quoted from the play. It's a new subtitle that highlights the hero's trademark state. Madness is what everybody knows about Hieronymo. Actually, including, of course, much later, the readers of The Wasteland. What readers of T.S. Eliot know about Hieronymo is that he's mad again. And the additions make it more crude and immediate than it was in the earlier version of the script. Clearly, in other words, Hieronymo mad was one of the things that audiences came to see, and the actors were anxious not to disappoint them. This connection, I think, between extreme emotion and madness makes sense if we recall early modern assumptions about what madness is. According to one model, not the only possible one, madness is a type of disorder. The passions ought to be under the government of reason, and when they overthrow that government, the result is mental anarchy, which extremely takes the form of madness. So Hieronymo's intensity of feeling and his madness are two degrees of the same thing. But this is a disturbing thought for contemporary moralists if it is true that this inner disorder, this uncontrolled passion, is what draws audiences to the playhouse. The story about the dying lady who wants to see Hieronymo is presented in both the versions that I cited as a fable about the dangers of theatre. In fact, one of them is from Histriomastics, William Prynne's 1,000-page demonstration of the unlawfulness of play-acting. Now, today, when going to the theatre to see plays like the Spanish Tragedy is a rather genteel and intellectual amusement, these attacks tend to look comical. But they become more understandable in the context which is implied by the Spanish Tragedy's popularity. From a Puritan or from a Stoic point of view, this theatre seems almost literally a madhouse, a small, enclosed space where hundreds of people gather together for the pleasure of working themselves up into a state of gratuitous emotional excitement, which weakens their reason and endangers their immortal souls. No wonder it was widely felt that this ought to be closed down. Okay. You'll remember, I hope, that there were going to be three bits. That's the first and longest of the three bits. The second bit is about theatricality. That's to say, about the idea that, which is also suggested by a number of the allusions to the play, that Hieronymo kind of stands in people's minds for theatre in general. Almost like this is the first play that comes to mind when you just mean a play. Okay, theatricality. A lot of this investigation takes the form of the material for this investigation takes the form of jokes and parodies. If the sheer number of references to Hieronymo tells us that the play remained popular, the tone of many of the references also tells us that it soon became fashionable to laugh at it. To reconstruct audiences' love for the play, we have to take these sneering, dismissive references and sort of read them backwards. One of the parodists' favourites is the play's first line. At the very beginning of the play, a character called Don Andrea has already been killed. And at the beginning of the show, his ghost appears on the stage and introduces itself to the audience, and that's how the play starts. And he says, "When this eternal substance of my soul did live imprisoned in my wanton flesh, each in their function serving others' need, I was a courtier in the Spanish court. My name was Don Andrea." And then off he goes into his story. And the best known of many parodies of this is the one in Beaumont's The Night of the Burning Pestle. The hero of The Night of the Burning Pestle is a grocer's apprentice who has various blatantly fictitious adventures and is persuaded at the end by his fans to round his story off with a tragic finale because he thinks it'd be the best way to go out. So for his last scene, the grocer's apprentice comes on with an arrow sticking through his head, comes down to the audience and says, "When I was mortal, this my costive corpse did lap up figs and raisins in the Strand." Now, Don Andrea is ludicrous because on the one hand he's supposed to be dead, but on the other hand he's walking around telling us things. That's the parodyable thing that's going on. And Beaumont, in The Night of the Burning Pestle, neatly parodies both the being dead, with the sort of Monty Pythonish arrow through the head, and also the insistence on the living body, that even the two lines that I read you have a number of scatological jokes in which I won't go into. But the original that's being parodied here, the lines that I've put on the screen, were clearly a memorable theatrical moment. Beaumont, like countless others, takes it for granted that everyone will recognise it. And so can we retrieve this opening moment from the burlesque and straighten it out? What did it sound like to people who took it seriously? One thing that made it memorable, I dare say, is just that it is the beginning. For those who remember being there, the opening line implies the whole show because it's the formula for the transition into theatrical time. It has the tremor of excitement that in other later theatres is associated with the house lights going down or with the roar of the MGM lion. It means, here we go. Of course, that's true of any opening of any play. This particular opening is then special simply because The Spanish Tragedy was a very well-known play. But I think there's more to it than that. There is something resonant about starting a show in this particular way. Now, as everyone knows, I guess, the open-air playhouses of early modern London have no front curtain and no lighting effects. So, like a sports pitch or a concert platform, the stage is plainly visible as the spectators arrive, and what announces the beginning of the entertainment is not the disclosure of a space that was previously hidden, but the appearance of players in what was previously an empty space. The moment when the lion roars, so to speak, is the moment when somebody comes on. He emerges from one of the upstage doors, approaches us, and begins to speak. Clearly, he is a different kind of being from us. He comes from another place. He enters from the tiring house, whereas we all came through the doors from the street. He is dressed differently. The fact that this theatre is not scenic does not in the least mean that it is not spectacular. We know that a great deal was spent on clothes, and that years later, in 1610, Hieronymo's old cloak, ruff, and hat could be found and identified in a playhouse wardrobe. And this guy speaks differently. His utterance is scripted, metrical, conspicuously artificial. In the Spanish tragedy, very conspicuously artificial. So this figure who appears on the previously empty stage is potentially uncanny, because although he is standing here in the familiar daylight, affected by the same sunshine or rain as the crowd, he nevertheless breathes the air of a different, unreal world. To make this disturbing, costumed figure a ghost is precisely appropriate. Don Andrea comes from another world in the literal sense that he is dead. His account of himself substantiates the strangeness of the moment when theatre begins. That, it seems to me, helps us to see why the Spanish tragedy might have affected its audiences, not just as one more play, but as the play that represents theatre as such. The ghost is celebrated because it constitutes a sort of myth of the actor, a supernatural story that accounts for his presence and his power. And not only the actor, actually, but the stage too. Don Andrea goes on to explain how he comes to be here before us. And the explanation is that because he died both as a lover and as a warrior, the rulers of the land of the dead were unable to decide which province of the underworld he should be put in. So what they've done is to entrust him to the allegorical figure of revenge who has brought him here. He seems to have little idea of where he is. He arrives in front of us and looks around and doesn't know where he's come to. And revenge, who is with him, explains, "Thou art arrived where thou shalt see the author of thy death deprived of life by Belimperia. Here sit we down to see the mystery." So Don Andrea, or rather the ghost of Don Andrea, has been mysteriously transported to a place where you can sit and watch how other people's lives work out. In other words, to a theatre. As in several other 1590s plays, I can think of A Midsummer Night's Dream or Dr. Faustus or The Old Wives' Tale, the theatre is conceived of as a place where visions appear, as if the costumed player had the power to call spirits into his circle. "Methinks I see thee, brave Hieronymo." The Spanish tragedy is the play that embodies this magical sense of what theatre can be, and that's why it's the play that stands for all plays. Okay, finally, I want to say something about popularity, about the class position of this play. Long ago, I gave Morris a title that suggested that Hieronymo was the people's tragic hero. I'm very uneasy about this phrase, which seems to be a semi-quotation from Tony Blair, something that anyone would want to avoid. But there is something interesting here about the way that, as well as being all the things I've attempted to describe, the Spanish tragedy is a rather down-market kind of entertainment. The mockery of the play that we find around the place includes a strong element of class condescension. The tailor and the grocer who borrow Hieronymo's gestures are being placed, like Bottom the Weaver in Pyramus and Thisbe, as people whose histrionic flourishes imply that they have ideas above their station. They are impressed by clunky scripts whose faults are obvious to the gentlemanly audience. The Spanish tragedy was almost certainly a staple of the open-air amphitheatres of the Rose and later perhaps of the Fortune, but the jokes about it mostly come from plays which were themselves first performed at indoor theatres. You can refer to the map that Morris was talking about and put it like this. This is a Blackfriars audience laughing at a Bankside repertoire. Ben Jonson, who you're going to hear about next week if you come back, seems to have had it in for the play for particular reasons which I don't have time to go into. And in 1598, he staged a dim-witted character called Matteo, who thinks that Hieronymo is just the best play ever. And this is Matteo talking to his friend. Indeed, here are a number of fine speeches in this book. O eyes, no eyes, but fountains fraught with tears. There's a conceit. Fountains fraught with tears. O life, no life, but lively form of death. It's not excellent. O world, no world, but mass of public wrongs. Oh, God's me, is it not simply the best you ever heard? Now, Matteo is a country boy who has inherited some land and now comes up to town to cut a figure as a gentleman. A taste for poetry is part of the character to which he aspires, so the rather harsh joke that Jonson is running is that Matteo doesn't have the style to go with his social pretensions, and his admiration for the out-of-date rhetoric of the Spanish tragedy gives him away. It depends on the Spanish tragedy being out of date, but the figure of fun doesn't seem to go out of date. In a comedy performed in Cambridge in 1614, a farmer plans to impress a girl with compliments, he says, drawn from the plays I see at the Fortune and Red Bull, where I learn all the words I speak and understand not. And sure enough, this satirical character's wooing is a burlesque adaptation of the O Eyes, No Eyes speech that Matteo likes. As late as 1632, at the Salisbury Court Theatre, again upmarket, Sir Gervase Simple, who is one that has but newly cast his country skin, came up to see the fashions of the town, has a scene in which he tries to get his revenge on the ladies who've been laughing at him by passing by them with disdain. And as he passes by them with disdain, he says, you guessed it, go by, Hieronymo, go by. In comic turns like these, what is essentially happening is that a low person is trying to talk high, but lacks the education or social contacts by which he would know what high really sounds like, and so he is reduced to copying the way they talk in plays. The Spanish tragedy has a quite specific function within this kind of class satire. It signifies a non-gentleman's idea of gentlemanly speech, and it is laughed at as that. Now, this suggests another interesting thing about the public theatres of early modern London, which is that they were the site of a sort of fantastical upward mobility. Because while they were a vehicle for aristocratic narratives, exhibiting the language and manners and clothes of courtiers, they were, as social institutions, open to anyone with a penny. The hostile version of this tension between upper-class events and lower-class spectators would be to say that the playhouse was a school of social deception, teaching plebs how to pass themselves off as their betters. That suspicion can indeed be heard in the anti-theatrical writings of the 1570s and 80s, the decades leading up to the composition of plays like the Spanish Tragedy. And of course, one distinctive thing about the play itself is that, like Hamlet after it, it is a court drama, entirely set within the lives of two royal households and mostly concerned with the fate of titled characters. Certainly, it is a play for common people. That is increasingly how it's placed by other writers. But equally certainly, it isn't a play about common people. It conforms to the convention that tragedy happens in palaces. But, as we have seen, the one in the play we love is not the king or the prince, it's Hieronymo. How high or low is he? As we're told early on, and reminded quite often, he is the King of Spain's knight marshal. Now, I don't know whether the real kings of Spain had a knight marshal, and I don't suppose for a moment that Thomas Kidd knew either. But the kings of England certainly did have such an official from 1236 until 1846. The office changed its nature over all that time, obviously, but it seems essentially to have been that of a sort of court policeman. This hadn't really occurred to me until I sort of started digging around, but of course, if you think about it, it's an inevitable function. The royal household in the 16th or 17th century was a fluctuating community of several thousand people, royals, aristocrats, bureaucrats, attendants, caterers, hangers-on. You know, the size of a small town. And for obvious reasons, these people were not subject to the ordinary jurisdiction of the local authorities. They were servants, or they were in some way attached to the monarch. And so they were, in that sense, above the local law. So the court needed its own mechanism for dealing with internal disorders and misdemeanors. And the knight marshal was the executive bit of that mechanism, responsible for taking offenders into custody, producing them for the appropriate judicial hearings, and so on. So, if our question is whether the knight marshal is high or low, the answer is interestingly ambiguous. On the one hand, he is a relatively humble individual. He is normally a knight, not a lord, and on an organisational chart of the Tudor court, his office appears on the same level as the bakehouse and the laundry, one of the many necessary but unglamorous departments that report to the counting house. On the other hand, the knight marshal exercises an authority which has been directly delegated to him by the monarch. Resisting his officers within the household is clearly a form of treason. In that sense, the knight marshal embodies the law. So you see what I'm saying, just very crudely, he is low in one way and high in another way. So, as a symbolic figure, which is of course what he becomes when he's made into a character in a play, the knight marshal appears as an official guardian of justice in the face of courtiers who are much more high-born and powerful than he is. Before looking at the way this works out in the play, it's worth pausing a moment over the politics of it. 16th and 17th century England was a hierarchical society and a very long way from being a democratic political system, obviously. But as some recent historians have argued, it had other forms of popular participation, non-electoral forms, one of which was office holding. It was normal, in fact, in lots of cases it was compulsory, for ordinary citizens to serve their communities as justices, bailiffs, constables, church wardens, vestrymen, and so on. These offices between them made up the detail of the way society was governed, and the ethos that shaped them, derived from both religious and classical sources, coalesced in the idea of the godly magistrate, the public office holder whose commitment to justice is not deflected by private fear or favour. One way this ideal was dramatised in the plays of the 1590s was in the figure of the good duke. Examples would include Shakespeare's Duke Humphrey in Henry VI, Part 2, Thomas of Woodstock, Sir Thomas More. This character, I mean, there are differences between them, but there's a kind of shared character. This character may be aristocratic, although, of course, More isn't, but he dresses and speaks plainly, carries out his public duties incorruptibly, and champions the interests of the poor. So in both a theatrical and a political sense, this figure represents the people. And Hieronymo, I think, is one such representative. His relationship with the royal characters in the play is that of an old and valued servant, praised, respected, patronized. When a murderer comes before him in the course of the plot, he appears as an incorruptible upholder of justice. He says to the malefactor, "Blood with blood shall, while I sit as judge, be satisfied and the law discharged." Later on, we see him besieged by petitioners who trust him to present their causes to the king. So his lowly status combines with his high responsibilities to make him the court spokesman for uncourtly people. He is our man in the elevated world of the stage. That's very tied up, it seems to me, with the idea that Hieronymo is not only a popular stage figure, but is loved. The point of this insistence, as far as the tragedy is concerned, is its bitter irony. Hieronymo, the wronged father, the bereaved father whose son has been murdered, punishes other malefactors, but is unable to punish the murderers of his son. And this is a speech from the play. "But shall I never live to see the day that I may come by justice of the heavens to know the cause that may my cares allay? This toils my body, this consumeth age, that only I to all men just must be, and neither gods nor men be just to me." In other words, Hieronymo, especially in the long suspension of the third act, is the paradigmatic figure of the good man in pursuit of his rights. His personal grief as wronged father interacts with his public function as knight marshal, and each legitimates the other. The personal wrong fills the search for justice with pathos, and the public function generalizes the personal grievance and equips Hieronymo to speak for all of us, for all the people whom power has wronged. Of course, the play isn't tied to the real knight marshal's job description. It expands his remit by making him a judge as well as an officer of the court. You see Hieronymo judging a case, which a real knight marshal wouldn't do. And it also, at the end, rather fancifully merges his role with that of the master of the revels. Hieronymo turns out to be also the person who's responsible for organizing court entertainments. So as the play goes on, his marshalcy works increasingly as a metaphor. As he loses patience, he says, "I'll make a pickaxe of my poniard and here surrender up my marshalship, for I'll go marshal up the fiends in hell to be avenged on you all for this." Under intolerable provocation, he moves from being knight marshal of Spain to being knight marshal of all the world, confronting the malefactors who are too highly placed to be touched, and eventually forcing them to acknowledge and fear him. I think it's easy to see how the fantasies of the popular audience are riding on him as he makes that transition. What's more, he achieves this reversal by an act of theatre. At this point, I just have very quickly to go back to the plot one last time. At the end, peace between Spain and Portugal is to be ratified by Belimperia's marriage to the Portuguese prince, and Hieronymo, ever the obliging servant, is to provide a dramatic entertainment as part of the celebrations. He puts on a tragedy, casting himself, Belimperia, and the princely murderers of his son, who are then all killed in the course of the performance. Standing before the kings on the corpse-strewn stage, Hieronymo explains in a final speech what he has done and why. This climactic moment then dramatizes the theatre's own fantastical capacity to overcome social hierarchy. The actor, after all, has a temporary power to dominate the spectators, even if the spectators are his social superiors. Thanks to this power, Hieronymo has a moment when he can master his masters, not merely in the sense that he succeeds in killing his enemies, but much more tellingly in the vivid theatrical spectacle of his authority and their helplessness. The kings sit there watching him, and there's nothing they can do. So to a storm of popular applause, he rounds up the great ones of the earth and marshals them to hell. No wonder this is the play you want to see one more time before you die. That's all.
Thank you very much, Peter. That was a marvellous exploration of the play and its multiple contexts. And hopefully we can take things a little further with some questions from the audience here. I think we've got a roving mic, haven't we? Yeah. Two. Okay. Sorry about the Blairite allusion, if it is. But it's part of the mix, isn't it?
No doubt. Yes, that's right.
Can I just hand it over to you?
Sure, yeah.
Are there any questions?
If someone asks questions I don't know the answers to, I'll come to you.
Yeah. Hi. First, thank you very much. That was a really fascinating lecture. And this is a bit of a strange question, but I was just thinking about this during your closing comments. Am I right in thinking that the play within the play that Hieronymo stages at the end, he asks them all to speak in different languages?
Yes, he does.
I just wonder if you've got any thoughts on why.
It's a very good question, and I don't. I mean, for people who don't know this background, it's a bizarre thing that that in organising the play... obviously, there's a scene in which Hieronymo has to persuade all the necessary people to be in it. And he also explains that each of the main characters is going to speak a different language. So it's going to be a macaronic play in English, in Spanish, in Italian, in Latin. And somebody objects very reasonably that this will make the whole thing incomprehensible. And Hieronymo simply says that's how it must be. Now, when the play appears in the script of the Spanish tragedy, it's all in English. In other words, this doesn't happen. And so there is an unresolved question, not only of what the point of this bizarre idea is, but also whether in performance it was done as Hieronymo describes it or as it's written in the script. And that's very difficult to tell. And, you know, obviously I've contemplated this question like anybody who's worked on the play, but I can't really see how it makes sense. I mean, obviously you can interpret it. You can say, for example, that trope in which a final performance turns into death and destruction and chaos... you know, just in the way that the play in Hamlet breaks up in disorder and the mask at the end of the Revenge's tragedy turns to murder and so on. Everybody learnt from Kidd to do this way of finishing a tragedy as a kind of broken and disturbed revel. And it goes with that in some kind of metaphorical way that... He's as it were, deliberately creating a show which breaks down in disorder because that's what's going on. But that's an interpretation that seems to me to be plausible rather than true. I put it forward because it's there, but I'm not sure I believe in it. Sorry, deeply unsatisfactory answer. Sorry, yes.
Yes, I enjoyed it very much too. Thank you very much. Is there another play or are there other plays that have anything close to the same level of parody and allusion in the literature from this period? Or does the Spanish tragedy stand head and shoulders above them, at least in the material that that has come down to us?
I think it does, actually. There are other plays which... it's reasonable to suppose we're equally popular. For example, there are obviously lots of editions of the Spanish tragedy, but it's not the play with the largest number of editions. I think it probably has fewer than Musidorus, which is another play now much more obscure than the Spanish tragedy is now, in fact, but which was clearly another popular staple in the repertoire. So it wasn't like uniquely famous, but I think it probably was uniquely parodied. I can't think of another play that keeps turning up in quite that way. And that, yeah, well, I've said what I think that means, but that suggests a kind of old war horse, you know, so that when the Spanish tragedy comes back, it's partly, you know, it's a bit like when they revive Playboy of the Western World in Dublin, you know, it's partly there's the dear old thing again, and partly, oh no, not again.
I was thinking of Hamlet, of course, as one of the obvious successors to Spanish tragedy.
Absolutely.
In terms of theatre. Except, of course, that in Hamlet, the acting simply reminds Hamlet of his job of doing revenge, and he then does it. You've got another two acts after that from the player scene. That's one. What I wanted to ask you, though, was about the staging of the final act. And do you think that the king and courtiers were trapped on the balcony?
Trapped?
On the stage balcony, locked away. Remember, Hieronymus has his key, doesn't he?
Yes.
Do you think that the courtiers are all held on the balcony as a kind of, in a form of entrapment, so that Hieronymus can play his game?
It's conceivable, but it seems to me to be counterintuitive in a certain way, just because of the very strong symbolic relationship that places the balcony as high and the stage as low. So that it's an elevating place to be. And so I think it's actually quite hard to read if that place, which is, you know, window, heaven, the walls of the city, suddenly turns into a prison. I just think it would be extraordinarily hard to read. I don't know what you think about that. That the experience of the, you know, the upper stage at the reconstructed Globe is that that's the way it tends to work.
The deaths take place on the upper stage, which makes it actually quite a lot easier for them to the bodies to be taken off stage from that point. But Hieronymo is on the main stage, isn't he? He must be on the main stage for
yes.
the finale. And I wondered whether his game played with the king and the courtiers and the people that he's murdering. Whether that was made more practicable if that had been done on the original stage. That always makes me think again of Hamlet as a version of Spanish tragedy, a much later version of the Spanish tragedy, one in which the player scene is done on the main stage, not up on the balcony. And indeed Hamlet and Ophelia and so on, and the King and Queen are sitting watching the play, aren't they, and talking about it, as something that is done perhaps from the discovery space on the Globe stage, as part of the physical structure of where they enacted it, as a deliberate contrast to the Spanish tragedy where it was done on the stage balcony, and where you've got that contrast between Hieronymo pretending to be master of the revels and compere of the show, as Hamlet is for the play within the play scene, which is a straight equation of Hamlet with Hieronymo, isn't it?
Sure.
But that presumably means that if the courtiers who are really being killed are up on the stage balcony, then Hamlet is being done as a deliberate contrast with Spanish tragedy's traditional formal staging. I mean, that the stage balcony thing is a crucial and complex feature of the final act in Spanish tragedy, I think. I'm rather strongly inclined to think that Lorenzo and the others are stuck up there to be murdered, as it were, visibly for everybody, in reality, where the king, watching it all, thinks that it's being done in act, in play,
yes,
rather than in reality. But that the reality has to happen on the main stage somehow. So it seems to me that you've got the king and courtiers sitting watching it from up on the balcony, where Jeronimo has the key to lock them in, and that Lorenzo and Balthazar are on the main stage doing their enacting. I mean, you've got a choice, haven't you, in terms of how it should be, how you think it might have been staged.
Yes.
Michael Bryant, at the when he was playing Jeronimo at the National Theatre, put himself up on the stage, on the balcony, as I remember.
I didn't see that show, yeah. I don't know what to say. I see the logic of what you're developing, but I think I'm inclined to resist it because what it's doing is sorting out the levels of theatrical illusion into clearly demarcated differences, and I think probably it's actually the interaction between play dead and really dead, that is what the climax leads to. So I think you actually have to have them in the same space, but I haven't directed it.
Can I ask a quite separate question about, you've got Portugal and Spain, and of course Portugal had just been, as it were, taken over by Spain in the 1580s, just about the time. Friend of Kidd's, the son of the Lord Mayor, was involved in the war, in the sea war, wasn't he, at that time in 1580? So Kidd would have had an almost first-hand account of the fight between the Spanish and the Portuguese that led to it. Do you think that lies behind the calling it the Spanish tragedy and having Lorenzo as the Portuguese heir to the throne being killed off by Jeronimo?
I'm terribly reactionary about interpretations of that kind, I must admit. I think that it follows from the way that I've been trying to construct the theatre as a space in what I've been saying, that it's a more, what would I say, a more formal and symbolic space than that. That's to say, there's a great deal of reading, not only of this play, but of many other contemporary plays, been done over the last 20 or 30 years on the assumption that there's a referential relationship between things that happen in the play and things that happen in the political or diplomatic history of the surrounding world. And I'm always a bit suspicious, actually, because I'm not convinced that the plays work like that. Clearly there are plays that do. I mean, you can point to specific examples. But it feels to me not like a statement, but like an appropriation of material. That's why, as I was arguing, the court is, I don't mean that it represents the English court, but it works like the English court because it's a court. And the English one is the one that people have any experience or knowledge of. So in a sense, I don't feel myself that the Spanishness of the Spanish tragedy or the Portugueseness of the other place in the Spanish tragedy is of great referential importance. But I'm aware that I'm in an embattled minority in looking at it like that.
Ha ha ha. Yeah, I just wondered if you were at all convinced by the new theory that the editions are by Shakespeare, the 1602 editions.
Yeah, I have to confess my lack of up-to-dateness. I only discovered that from reading your own material on the website, which is excellent. So I haven't seen the argument, as it were.
I think it's just been a kind of computerized, technical kind of scope of the way people use language.
Right, right.
There's an argument that it could be Shakespeare, but I don't have any strong views. I just wondered if...
Right.
Do you think it's plausible? Oh, sorry, yeah.
Okay, the question is that it's been suggested more than once recently that the additions to that I referred to, the additions, yeah, I mean, there's a documentary association with Johnson which convinces nobody because it seems so wildly implausible that Johnson would have written the additions as they are. They're clearly not by Kidd because he was dead by the time they were added, so there is a question of who wrote them, and the new idea is that it was Shakespeare. I suppose I'm skeptical for two reasons. One is they don't sound to me like Shakespeare, and the Shakespearean interpolation that we know is real, the one in the Book of Sir Thomas More, does sound like Shakespeare. I mean, God, straight away you think, there's got to be. And you don't think that with these, so that's, you know, that doesn't rule it out, but it sort of makes it a little bit less plausible. And then there's something a little bit, there's something a little bit suspect about identifying Shakespeare because he's the one we've all heard of, you know? There's a sweet little Kipling story in which the editors of the authorized version of the Bible are stuck for a wonderful phrase at a particular point in the Bible. And so, you know, this wandering player happens to be wandering down the street, so they ask him. And, you know, it's just a kind of irresistible myth that there is a phrase of Shakespeare lodged in the King James Bible somewhere. And it's, do you see what I mean? It's a bit like that. Does it have to be Shakespeare?
whatever reason, the lecture was called partly the enduring popularity of the play, Spanish Tragedy. Although I don't know about documentary evidence, but is there any sense in which there was a persistent love of this play going into until the theatres were closed in 1642, because the Red Bull and the Fortune as amphitheatre theatres did go right up to that moment, that is there any evidence for the enduring popularity as opposed to cynicism or the examples you gave of plays where quotes were used,
right,
as a sort of parody. Do you get a sense that they were unflinchingly supported? That Hieronymo was indeed a kind of popular hero of some sort.
Well, up to that, I think so. There isn't very much in the way of what you would call positive evidence, which is why my argument is constructed essentially by taking negative evidence and reading it backwards. When you talk about a kind of staunch keeping faith with the Spanish tragedy, you're almost quoting another of Johnson's jokes. I think it's in the beginning of Bartholomew Fair, where he says, you know, if you've got somebody who insists after all these years that Hieronymo is the best play ever, then at least you've got to give him the credit of consistency, you know. He may be sort of thick and conservative and have no taste, but at least he's consistent. You've got to respect him for that. And that's a kind of joke about a kind of faithfulness to the play. But positively, no. And I don't think there are any documentary traces of performance even after 1600, are there? I don't think so. That
it's not that kind of evidence. But it doesn't seem to me to be implausible that it went on being revived and didn't happen to leave traces. And it seems to me quite implausible that this network of references and allusions and parodies, which amounts to sort of 100 or so in surviving plays, should all be circulating around a play that was no longer being revived. I mean, it must have been.
That seems to make sense, doesn't it? And into the restoration, as you started out by saying, too.
Yes, although it, like a lot of Jacobean plays, its reputation and revivability seems to drop like a stone after the restoration. It doesn't fit into the restoration theatre at all.
Had you, Andy, any thoughts on evidence?
There is evidence. Of course, part of it comes from the frequency with which it was, the quartos were reprinted through that period. But there are two references, I think. One by Gayton about Hieronymo being staged in his memory, and he was writing in 1644 or so about his memory of theatre in the 1630s.
Right.
So there are references to the fact that the Tamburlaine and Spanish tragedy, which were always grouped together, were still being staged at the open air theatres, which had become known as the citizen playhouses, downmarket,
right.
In other words,
yeah.
By the 1630s. There's a fairly good amount of evidence about them, they being continuing to be staples of the repertory right the way through.
Right. Oh, well, I'm reassured. I'm not fantasizing. That's good. Tamburlaine is a sort of another example for you, actually. There are enough allusions to suggest that people who'd never seen the play knew who Tamburlaine was.
There are two people in Ludlow, of all places, in Shropshire, there are two people who were named Tamburlaine in 1620, I think as a result of the fact that the play was being toured around the country and that Tamburlaine was so notable that the two... One who became provost of Ludlow in later years, and the other was a major mercer in the town. But they were both named Tamburlaine in the same, roughly the same. They were born at about the same time, 1621. So the assumption is that sometime in 1621 there was a visit of London players performing Tamburlaine at that time.
Thanks very much, Peter, for that marvellous lecture, and thanks for your questions, which are all recorded, and you'll be able to hear again on the website in due course. Thanks very much. Thank you. Just to remind you that we've got another lecture next Sunday, a week today, and it's, as I said at the outset, I think, by Julie Sanders, Professor Julie Sanders from University of Nottingham. It's called Ben Jonson, Bankside and the Blackfriars, a biography of London theatre districts in the 17th century. And you should be able to get, if you haven't already got one, a flyer, a sheet about this lecture that you've just had today, and also Julie's next week, describing something about her and what she's going to be talking about. So look forward to seeing you again, I hope, next week and in succeeding weeks, and I hope you've enjoyed it. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
to just rip it out of the side in case it does something wrong.
Yeah. We'll just have a look.
If we get to the